and it's not a matter of transcendental reason.
Well, let's go on to the contemporary debate. Finally, right? All that background. One thing you have to... It would be. I prefer to get some more done right now. Contemporary transcendental arguments, remember, keep this in your back, in the background, are always aimed at the skeptic. The skeptic comes with a certain challenge, and so a transcendental argument is going to try to defeat the skeptic. Okay, remember, let's do a quick review. Transcendental arguments conclude with transcendentals. They take this certain type of form. For X to be the case, Y has to be the case, because Y is a precondition of X. X is the case, therefore Y is the case. That's the general form they take. And they have, and there's differences between transcendental arguments. There's ontological transcendental arguments and conceptual, and then Kantian. Okay, so that's all in the background. Contemporary transcendental arguments try to defeat the skeptic. The most famous contemporary transcendental argument is found in Sir Peter Strawson's book, Individuals, an Essay in Descriptive Metaphysics. This was published in 1959, and kind of set off the whole modern debate. And so what I thought I would do is read for you and give you a taste of what a modern contemporary transcendental argument is like, to give you a feel for them and enable you to compare them to Vantillian transcendental arguments. Then we could try to draw some analogies between them. We'll look at some of the criticisms of Strawson's arguments, and then we'll see if they apply to Vantill. Some of the arguments against Strawson are fairly powerful. And so if there's a close enough analogy between Strawson's transcendental arguments and Vantillian transcendental arguments, there's a potential difficulty there for our apologetics. Okay, so that's why we're doing this. There's an important relevance to Vantillian transcendental arguments. I'm just going to read to you from page 35 of Individuals. This is his most famous argument of the book. Now, I'm warning you, it's a bit difficult, but I'll explain things as we go along. Strawson, Strawson. Sir Peter Strawson. Obviously from Britain. There is no doubt that we have the idea of a single spatio-temporal system of material things. What is he talking about? Don't let the fancy talk scare you. All he's saying is, when we view the world, we picture the world as a single spatial temporal continuum. And what he means by that is that my experience now, I assume that my experience now has some relationship to my experience in this room yesterday, and then my experience at home the day before, and my experience at church Sunday. I assume that the objects I saw at church Sunday are in some relationship, spatial relationship, to the objects I see now. In other words, I conceive of the world as having one space. All things I see, all material objects, are in one single space, rather than different dimensions, different types of space. You know, take for example, although heaven's a physical place, it's in a different type of space than Irvine, California. Okay, I could get to Irvine from Placentia, but I can't get to heaven from Placentia in the same way I could get to Irvine from Placentia. Okay. Well, some people have claimed that, but all Strawson is saying is we have this. This is the way we commonsensically view the world. Okay. Now, what he's setting up is here comes a skeptic who's going to question this. The skeptic comes, one form of skepticism says that we can never know things have identity through time. This chair was here yesterday, or so I thought it was. I come into this room today and see this chair here. I assume it was the same chair here as the chair that was here yesterday. Some philosophers come up and ask, well, how do you know it's the same chair? Were you continually observing it? Now, this is a question of identity in philosophy. How do you know? What makes for something to be the same through time? Since I wasn't sitting here observing it the whole time, why am I in a position to say, yeah, this is the same chair that was here yesterday? Okay, so the skeptic brings up that contention. How do you know that material objects have identity through time? That's the skepticism that Strawson wants to take on. So he starts off by saying, there is no doubt that at least we think that objects have identity through time. We view the world as having one spatial temporal continuum, that objects that I see yesterday are in some relationship spatially and temporally with the objects I see today. There is no doubt, he says, that this is our conceptual scheme. Now, Strawson is sometimes can be sloppy, and he's sloppy here. There's no doubt that this is part of our conceptual scheme, he should say. This certainly isn't all of our conceptual scheme, but this is part of it. Now he turns to... all he's saying is there, this is certainly how we view the world. Now he turns to the hub of his argument, and it's very subtle. He says, now I say that a condition, and what he means there is a necessary condition, not a sufficient condition, but a necessary condition of our having this conceptual scheme that all objects are in one spatial temporal continuum is the unquestioning acceptance of particular identity and at least some cases of non-continuous observation. More jargon, right? What he's saying there is if we have this conceptual scheme that I just mentioned, then the necessary precondition of it, put this on the board, if we have, I'll just use the same letters. If we have this conceptual scheme, call it X, that all objects, we believe at least, that all objects are in the same space and time continuum, then claims Strawson that the necessary condition for this is Y. And what is Y? Y is that our having this conceptual scheme, the condition for having this conceptual scheme, is the unquestioning acceptance of particular identity and at least some cases of non-continuous observation. What he's saying here simply, that in order to have this conceptual scheme, we sometimes have to come into a room and say, oh, that's the same chair that was there yesterday. In other words, we have to, when we stop observing something and then see it again later, say, well, that's the same thing I saw earlier. We do that all the time. I went to bed last night and the last thing I saw was my alarm clock. Now, when I woke up in the morning, in as much as I thought about it, I said, that's the same alarm clock that was there last night. I didn't look at it and say, well, I imagine that. That's a similar alarm clock than the one that was sitting on my counter when I went to bed. Okay, I assume, unquestionably, that some objects, when I stop perceiving them, are the same when I perceive them again. Now, I'm being sloppy. I'm begging the question in that statement. But all I'm saying is, when we come into our experience is such that when we stop observing things and we see them again, we don't say that they're different things. We just say that they have continued to exist even though we haven't observed them. Yeah, he's appealing to our unquestioning acceptance that we sometimes re-identify things even though there's an interruption in our observation of that thing. That's the hub of the argument. Okay, he's going to do something really cute and interesting with this form. But this is the setup. He says, we have X, and nobody wants to doubt X. That's just the way we view the world. Okay, so everybody, and including the skeptic, agrees with X. Y is more controversial, though. Now here comes his reductio argument for Y. He's going to now assume not Y. And he's going to show that if Y is not the case, X is not the case. Now, what happens once he does that? We already know that X is the case. The skeptic agrees with that. So then it's not X, not Y. And so therefore, Y, so we've established Y. Now, what happens? We'll get to the punchline right now. What happens if we established why? What was the skeptic trying to do? The skeptic is trying to question whether things continually exist through time when we don't perceive them. He says, how do we know that that lamp is the same one as was there yesterday when we saw it there? I wasn't observing that lamp the whole time. Oh, I could even close my eyes right now and then open it. Now, I'm assuming that the lamp I saw before I closed my eyes is the same one. the skeptic says, well, how do you know that? Strawson's point, the point of Strawson's argument, is to say that whole question, that whole skeptical challenge, can't even get off the ground. The reason is to have this conceptual scheme, the one in which the skeptic accepts, remember, he's not questioning that we have this conceptual scheme, he's just questioning it's an appropriate conceptual scheme. He's just having doubts about whether it's true or not. But he doesn't doubt that we have it. Strawson maintains that a precondition for having this conceptual scheme is that we have to, at least in some cases, unquestionably assume that things continue to exist through time, even though they're unperceived. Now, that knocks off the legs from out of the skeptic. Why is that? Well, if he has to assume that things continue to exist in time to have this conceptual scheme, then his skepticism doesn't make any sense. He's calling into question the precondition of his conceptual scheme. Okay, is that too fast? Okay. X is the fact that we have the idea that things continue to exist in a... Well, it's even more general than that, that there is a single spatial-temporal continuum. Everything, every material object is in the same time, in the same space as every other material object. Why is the alleged necessary precondition for X? Y says that in order for X to be the case, we have to, at least in some cases, assume that objects continue to exist even though we don't perceive them. Then I haven't got to his reductio argument yet. I'm just giving you the punchline. The punchline is, assuming that Strawson's reductio is correct, that if this is the case, if Y is a precondition for X, and Y says that you have to unquestionably, at least in some cases, believe that objects continue to exist unperceived, then for the skeptic to come up to you and say, how do you know that lamp is the same one there yesterday? Or how do you know anything that you experience now is the same thing that you experienced yesterday? Or in other words, how do you know that there's been a continual existence in that chair or any other particular thing? The answer to him, according to Strawson, is you can't even formulate that skepticism. It makes no sense whatsoever. Because in order to formulate it, you have to assume Y. And Y says that you have to assume that things continue to exist unperceived. So the skeptic is saying, in other words, that he asks, well, how do you know things continue to exist unperceived? But even in asking that, he has to assume that objects continue to exist unperceived.
I hope it will clarify. There's two kinds of skepticism that we might talk about. The skeptic might come in and say, how do you know that particular chair is the same one that was there particularly yesterday? Because how do you know there wasn't some very clever guy who went to the furniture store and last night when Dr. Bonson was asleep, substituted one chair for another? Now that's a particular objection or a particular question and challenge. It envisions furniture stores, people coming in at night and so forth. Now, that's not what Strawson is refuting. To refute that, and somebody posed that, you have to say, well, what's the evidence, pro and con, and all that. What he's talking about in considering absurd is what we might call general skepticism. I don't have any particular reason to wonder about that chair in this situation. I'm just saying, in general, how do we know things continue? And Strawson is saying, well, you have to assume that even to raise the argument. I hope that helps, because you might go home thinking, well, then we know everything. No one could ever deceive us. Strawson knows we can be deceived. It says you have to have reason for things to be deceived. You can't just have a general skepticism. How do we know everything is false? Or how do we know that we can't... Why don't we just say we can't know anything? That's just too general.
Right.
To even say that is to assume you can know
something. Right. Very good. Well, we're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we'll start off with questions. We'll finish this up and then go over the relevance this has to Van Til.